Lunar Science. Welcome to Lunar Science, the series in which we discuss the scientific investigation of the Moon and its environment in the Artemis era. The Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, or LRO, was placed into orbit around the Moon in 2009. Its best-known instrument is LROC, the camera that has the resolution to show the walking and driving tracks of the Apollo astronauts. Episode 41 is the first of two about this amazing spacecraft. Emerson Spayura has been using LROC to explore the lunar South Pole. One of the points of interest are the permanently shadowed regions, or PSRs. The orbiter has two cameras, a wide-angle, or WAC, WAC, or a narrow-angle, or a NAC, NAC.
So the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, as many of you know, is made up of two separate camera systems. One is the narrow-angle camera, which has meter-scale observations of the Moon. And this is ideal for looking close up at features and trying to characterize landing sites and things like that. We also have the wide-angle camera, which provides synoptic imaging of the poles and with high temporal resolution, so a lot of repeat coverage of the terrain. And this is ideal for making movie sequences as well as making illumination maps. We've recently been getting requests for, you know, hey, can we acquire a new image of this area under this lighting condition? And usually we can go through our database and be like, oh, well, here's an image we took back in 2012 and it matches your criteria. So for the narrow angle camera, we have about 200 images that include the pole itself. And as you work away, you can see we're approaching 100,000 observations within the Artemis zone. And then with the wide-angle camera, we have about 10,000 observations that cover the pole itself. And then as you work away from the pole, we're approaching around 50,000 observations with the wide-angle camera. So we have a lot of data that covers this region that's already in the PDS. And we still have opportunities to collect more, and I'll talk about that here in a few minutes. But another question that we sometimes get is what the spatial resolution of the cameras are in the polar region. So it's a little bit different. We, with the narrow angle camera, we collect images in a summing mode. So during the nominal phase of the mission, when we were in the 50 kilometer orbit, our observations were about 50 centimeters per pixel. But in the polar regions, we would sum each neighboring pixel together and expose for twice as long. And basically each pixel would have four times as amount time to get photons into the CCD, and so our pixel scale is reduced to about a meter. And with all the orbit variation, you can see that we're right around between 1 meter and 1.5 meters. But you can still identify pretty small features even with this resolution. So even if there was a meter-sized boulder, you have to remember that the incidence angle in this region is always close to 90 degrees, and so they cast really long shadows, and so you can see very small features in these images. And then with the wide-angle camera, you can see that we have the spatial resolution varies from about 45 meters per pixel to about 105 meters per pixel. All right, so just want to overview, give you an idea of what data products we have out there. And so this is a NAC mosaic, which is sampled at 1 meter per pixel. We've produced this map using images that we collected pretty on early on in the mission, and it goes about to 85.5 degrees to 90 degrees. In addition to an ACK mosaic, we also have a WAC mosaic. These are what we're calling the summer mosaics. So we have one for each pole. They go from 45 degrees all the way up to the pole, and it shows the polar region at local noon as well as during the summer time. So when, in the case for the South Pole, when the subsolar latitude is around negative 1.5 degrees. And so, and we did a lot of work to try to make sure that this was a useful product. In addition to just collecting single observations, we've also worked hard in the early part of the mission to create these polar movies. So basically we were collecting observations about every 2 hours, and there was a lot of overlap near the poles. And so we have these movie products available online to where you can actually watch how this lighting changes as a function of time. And so you can go and play those movies and zoom in close to the center or have the whole polar view and kind of get an idea for how the lighting varies from hour to hour. As part of this product, in addition to just creating these movie files, we've also map projected about 8,000 images that you can go and download. So these observations are already map projected. You don't have to worry about processing the images at all. And this is a great resource if you want to look at a particular region under a particular lighting condition, as well as being able to study things like for terrain relative navigation. So how do certain features look under different lighting? Instead of trying to simulate an image, you can actually just pull up one of these images and see what it looks like. All right. In addition, we've also made WAC illumination maps. You know, the LOLA team has done a great job creating illumination products as well. In addition to WAC illumination maps, we've also have been still working on making some NAC illumination products. So this is taking those 100,000 NAC observations in the polar regions and trying to get a good idea for what the illumination conditions look like at smaller scales. The temporal variation isn't, or the temporal resolution isn't as high as what we're seeing with the WAC. However, we can basically identify areas in the polar regions where we've never imaged it when it's been illuminated. And so these are probable PSRs. So in addition to that, we also have a permanently shadowed region atlas. So these are all taken with long exposure observations. So instead of taking meter scale images, we're taking one long exposure, so roughly covering 20 or 40 meters. And then we process those images and look at scattered light inside of permanently shaded craters. One other set of observations that we're collecting now is obliques. So we are moving away from the pole, and so we can't always image the Shackleton de Gerlach Ridge, for example, in a nadir view, but we can actually slew off nadir and take these beautiful oblique images. And in addition to their beauty, you can also look at them to see whether certain regions are illuminated and things like that. Thank you.
Emerson Spayura. At his base in Arizona State University, Spayura is poring over the images from the Lunar Reconnaissance Camera looking for changes in the moon. Such changes can be new craters.
When the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter mission started, one of the primary science objectives for LROC, the last but not the least listed in the science overview paper, or the instrument overview paper, was to look for new impact craters. And when the mission was first conceived, it wasn't supposed to last a decade. And so the idea was that we would compare high resolution observations that we're collecting during the mission to Apollo PAN observations that were collected during Apollo 15, 16, and 17. And Ingrid Dalbar led an effort to actually look through the Apollo PANs and compare them to the LROC NAC images. And through that work, they found a handful of new impact craters. So one of the surprising events that occurred during the mission was that there were two large impact flashes that occurred. One that was on March 17th of 2013, and that formed an 18-meter crater. And the second one was on September 11th. Which formed a 34-meter crater. And if you, but once these two events occurred, we started developing techniques to where we could actually compare narrow angle camera images from LROC to other narrow angle camera images from LROC to look for these type of surface changes. And so this started an effort to start scanning through systematically through the entire data set, looking for images with similar lighting and viewing geometries. So far, we've searched through 24,000 NAC temporal pairs, which correlates to about 3.6 trillion pixels. These are pretty large images that we're scanning through. And we're also doing other searches where we're looking for new impact craters that have formed since the Apollo mission, since the Clementine mission, since the Kikuyu terrain camera observations, as well as actually comparing WAC mosaics to other WAC mosaics, getting us an idea of the rate of larger impacts on the moon. With the narrow angle camera, we've covered about 21% of the surface. There is a little asymmetry, and that's just due to the altitude variations of the spacecraft. So we get a little bit better coverage, but lower resolution in the northern hemisphere, and a smaller amount of coverage, but higher resolution in the southern hemisphere. So one of the things that was discovered when we first started looking at these impacts, this is an example of a temporal ratio image, similar to the one that Brett showed earlier, of an after image divided by a before image. And from that, you can see that there's four different zones that are identified around that crater. And so there are four distinct zones and around this one 18-meter crater. And then when we started looking at the hundreds and hundreds of more craters that we were identifying across the moon, we were also seeing a variety of craters that had all four zones. Some of them only had one or two zones, but it was an interesting discovery that we made. So one of the outstanding questions that's coming out of this work is, you know, how large of an area is affected by these newly formed impacts? We saw in talk two before me where they were showing these diviner cold spots that go over such a large area. And in fact, some of these large craters, including this one here, are actually showing up as diviner cold spots. And so we have a great understanding of what's happening close to the crater, but there's still questions that need to be addressed as we work our way out into more of the distal zones. And this affects not only our interpretation of remotely sensed observations, but could also be hazardous to future astronauts. And to just give you a sense of scale, hopefully your screen resolution is good enough, you'll see that white little dot right at the center there. That's actually the crater. So the crater is 70 meters in diameter, and these distal rays that are going from it extend out over 100 kilometers. So some of these impacts are actually changing quite a large area. So one of the other discoveries that was made with the March 17th impact is this collection of sparse distal ejecta, which were called splotches. And these are local changes to the surface reflectance. There's no actual visible rim in any of these features. And there's several different hypotheses for how they could form. One is that they could be a swarm of small primary impacts that were coming with the major bolide that created the 18-meter crater. Or they could be unrelated primary craters that have formed just around the same time. Or they could be small secondary impacts. And so and we believe that many of these are going to be small secondary impacts because some point actually back to the crater itself. In fact, that's how the location of the crater was first found. We were first looking at observations that were too far to the west, and then we could kind of see the direction of how these splotches were emplaced, and it pointed back to the primary crater. And some of this is correlated with the ray structure itself. One thing to note is that many of these are low reflectance, so about 90%, and they just change the reflectance ever so slightly, only a few percent. But when we have these high reflectance splotches, which are a much smaller population, they're actually increasing surface reflectance quite a bit, like 10%. Are these new splotches? So we've so far counted 120,000. Still questions remaining on, you know, what the impact of all these distal secondaries are. And so the idea right now is that you have this material that's coming out from the primary impact crater, and it's actually churning the surface. And when the mature layer is really thick, you're just kind of roughening up that surface and creating that low reflectance splotch. But on the right-hand side, you can see an example where the mature layer is really thin, and you're actually bringing up the brighter immature material, and therefore creating a high reflectance splotch. Splotch in this case. And so that's kind of like the formation mechanism that we're kind of looking at. But What we've also seen is, based on that coverage that I showed you on the previous slide, that these can actually cover the entire moon in less than 100,000 years. So it's a pretty quick rate of coverage, but there's still questions that remain. You know, there's been some modeling work, but you know, there's still questions to remain on how deep, to what depth these sparse distal secondaries are able to churn the regolith, and that can impact both space weathering, actually the presence, and how well you can keep surface volatiles, and they could also be potentially hazardous. And so basically these temporal images are a really good resource for not only identifying some of these newly formed impact craters and distal secondaries, but also characterizing this. We've done a lot of work that wasn't shown here in this presentation on the photometric properties of these new impacts and what we can discern from the different cratering mechanics.
Arizona State University's Emerson Spayura. Cameras are not the only instruments on the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. An instrument called LAMP has been helping Lizeth Magana, a research scientist at the Southwest Research Institute in San Antonio, to look for ice on the lunar surface.
Yes. Hello, everyone. Before I get started, for those of you that don't know me, I wanted to introduce myself. I am a fifth-year graduate student right now at the University of Texas at San Antonio, and research assistant at the Southwest Research Institute, where I work with Kurt Rutherford. So today I wanted to talk about how we can use LRO LAMP to look at hydration on the moon, not necessarily just within the permanently shadowed regions, but also on the day side of the moon. All right, so LAMP, or the Lyman Alpha Mapping Project, is a far UV imaging spectrograph, and we are able to operate it using two different modes. And these are the day side mode and the night side mode. So the day side mode we use when we're looking at solar illuminated surfaces of the moon. And we're able to use a traditional photometry technique where the sun is the main illumination source. However, on the night side or at the PSRs, we don't have the sunlight. So we actually use something that's a little different. We use the background starlight and the Lyman Alpha sky glow as the main illumination sources. And then looking at both of these data sets together and looking at the hydration features in both, we are able to piece together a unique perspective on the lunar hydrological cycle. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. So I mentioned we have detected hydration on the day side of the moon. This was done by Hendricks et al. In 2012, and then a follow-up study by Hendricks et al. In 2019. So we're showing the hydration features for the highlands and for the Maria. And what we're seeing is that in the local morning hours, we have fairly constant hydration. But right around noon, there is a change in slope, and this is actually interpreted as a loss of hydration. So what we think is happening is we have the solar wind protons that are coming in and interacting with the iron oxide in the lunar regolith, which actually forms H2O. And when the lunar regolith is fairly cold, the H2O is able to adsorb onto the regolith. But then as temperatures start to heat up right around noon, the H2O molecules and the regolith are heating up, so the H2O will desorb and actually move to locations that are cooler. And now the hydration that was shown here in this paper was actually consistent with up to 1% H2O. So looking at this with context and what we know about the PSRs, this is helping us form a broader picture. So then that brings me to the permanently shaded regions. We know that these regions are extremely cold. They can get down to about 50 Kelvin, which means that water ice is able to accumulate within them and be stable for billions of years. The issue is we can't really use our dayside mode to look at these regions because there is no sunlight illumination within the permanently shaded regions. So luckily, we actually have LAMP's nightside technique to look inside of them. And how that works is as LRO is orbiting around the moon, it is detecting all of this reflected light off of the lunar surface. And although we don't have reflected sunlight, we do have reflected starlight and Lyman Alpha sky glow within the permanently shaded regions. So accumulating this throughout several years, that allows us to image within these PSRs. Yeah, so how this works is we have the reflected light. We are then able to model what we think the illumination should be. And by taking the ratio of those two, That gives us the albedo at the South Pole. And we are able to do this throughout any wavelength regions that we choose. So we have defined three different wave bands of interest based off of the H2O spectroscopic features in the far ultraviolet. And what we see is that we actually have evidence of water ice within almost all of these cold traps that we're looking at. Now, with the off-to-on-band ratio at the South Pole, it helps us find locations where water ice might be present, but we can also make these off-to-on-band ratio maps at lower latitudes. And what really stands out from looking at this map are these bright crater rays. So these crater rays have really high off-to-on-band ratio. And they are also consistent with the exposure of fresh, immature regolith. That is, it is relatively unweathered, which also means it has low amounts of submicroscopic iron. So by looking at maps like this, they help us look at relative ages of different regions and different features on the moon. Yeah, and that brings me to my summary. So to conclude, LRO LAMP data sets can be used both on the day side and on the night side. To characterize the hydration. So on the day side, we're able to look at the day side hydration, but also we're able to look at relative ages of different regions and look at the regolith maturity. Again, on the night side, the off-to-on-band albedo ratio allows us to characterize condensed water, at least the locations for those, so it helps us figure out where that condensed water may be. Lastly, we have seen evidence of condensed water within many different cold traps.
Lysif Magana. Although it has been circling the moon since 2009, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter is still functioning well. Noah Petro is a scientist on the LRO team. In November of 2020, he gave this update and looked forward to the second decade of LRO science.
Thanks for the invitation to talk about LRO. This is not only are we in a really unique period of time, not just what's going on right now, but you know, for the last decade, we've had a mission at the moon, LRO. And so we're at this really important juncture in our understanding of the moon. And LRO remains sort of this this critical piece of hardware in lunar orbit that will guide us to the lunar surface. Just give a quick update. LRO is healthy. Our spacecraft is good. We have an 11-year-old spacecraft now orbiting the moon. And for any parent of 10-year-olds or 11-year-olds, you know, as things age, things change, and we've adapted to the changes on the spacecraft rather well. We have a penumbral eclipse coming up. These small eclipses, while they don't present significant challenges to the spacecraft, do force us to think critically about how we maintain the spacecraft, and so we'll be watching that very carefully. We have moved our operations center. This happened just before the pandemic set in, and so we're in new space at Goddard, and that's worked out well for us in this new era. We're now in our fourth extended science mission. We're about 1 year into that. This current extended mission runs out September 15th, 2022, and we anticipate submitting a proposal to NASA in the next year and a half to extend our operations for an additional 3 years beyond that. During this extended science mission, we have three total eclipses of the moon. And so those are obviously a little bit more significant for us to operate through. But we've done this now a number of times over the last decade. And so we're confident that even though we have a mature spacecraft, that we'll be able to get through those with no issues. Okay, so I've said time and time again, LRO relies on four P's, and it's actually five P's, I realize it. We rely on propellant. And so I'll talk a bit about our remaining propellant in a moment. We rely on power to the spacecraft. We write proposals, but of course the science community writes proposals to use our data. And so those are things that we point to when we write these extended mission proposals to highlight the use and the utility of our spacecraft and the data that comes from it. Publications, again, from both within the science team and outside the science team, and our data deliveries to the PDS. I'll talk more about each of these coming up. After orbit insertion in 2009, we were in first for a few months in a stable orbit. We moved to a 50-kilometer circular mission orbit, which required monthly station keeping, major burns. That reduced our fuel quite significantly. Towards the end of 2011, we went into what's called a frozen orbit, and that has ensured this long-duration mission for LRO. Basically, if we had not done that, we would have run out of fuel. We would have litho-braked sometime in 2012, But now here we are 8+ years later and still going strong. So it was that decision that has gotten us to this point. It's hard to remember 2011 very clearly anymore, but it was that clear decision that got us to this long duration mission at the moon. You know, our orbit has changed over time. That 2-year period of our prime science mission, we were in that 50-kilometer circular orbit. We're now in this elliptical orbit, which takes us high over the North Pole, low over the South Pole, but that has changed over time. We're now drifting away from the pole with time towards a more circular orbit at about 100 kilometers. We've also drifted away from the South Pole. As the moon moves below us, we are shifting towards higher and higher latitudes. So we now pass on every orbit over about 86 degrees south, 86 degrees north as well. And over time, the location of that close approach, our periaps, has shifted. Again, when we were in our circular orbit, we passed close over essentially the entire lunar surface, and now our periaps passes over the South Pole. We've delivered over 1 petabyte of data. I think we should rename the planetary data system to the lunar data system with some other planets data included. We do deliveries every 3 months, and our camera team, LROC, now delivers data every month. So this is sort of the gift that keeps on giving. And it goes without saying that this stable orbit we're in has given us an opportunity to really study the South Pole in really exquisite detail. And I'll highlight some of those data sets in a moment. So we will continue to deliver data and generate data products from new collections of data that are going to be relevant to the Artemis program. We have a number of data products that really are unique. And I wanted to sort of highlight something that Julie, I think, suggested. You know, we have several disparate data sets, but a real strength comes when we merge our data products together. But these are also data products that we can merge with other data sets to really kind of expand our understanding of what's going on in the South Pole. Over the last decade, many of the LRO instruments have developed new modes of operation to collect new types of data. And so this is really kind of how we have continued to probe the moon in new and interesting ways. Not only do we measure the moon differently, but of course we create new and improved data products. And I'd like to sort of forecast to the future between CLPS missions and Artemis that having a mission like LRO, or indeed having LRO active while those missions are operating on the ground, affords us a really unique opportunity to connect surface measurements to orbital measurements and really probe new ways of understanding how the moon interacts, not just with the space environment, but how it changes over human timescales. And so with some of these improvements, we're going to find really some exciting new ways to interrogate the moon. I highlight at the top right an improved LOLA albedo product. This improvement obviously provides not only a higher spatial resolution, but again, kind of a better granularity of understanding some of the albedo features, albedo differences across the South Pole. I'd be remiss not to talk about the CRADR instrument, our radiation detector, which is providing a measure of the deep space radiation environment, looking at the allowable exposure time for astronauts in deep space and how that evolves as a function of solar activity. And so it's kind of the full suite of LRO data that helps us understand not just where to go, but, you know, again, what the crew can expect when we get there. And I'd like to think, and maybe I'm just a proud project scientist, but that LRO data is the backbone of our preparation for the Artemis missions to the moon. And, you know, as long as LRO will be flying at the lunar surface, we will characterize the Artemis zone. After about 2025, we'll start characterizing what I'm wishfully calling the proximal Artemis zone, areas near 84 South, but again, valuable data for understanding the South Pole of the moon. I'm proud of the job that our teams continue to do in delivering new data, and we look forward to an exciting future of many more years orbiting the moon.
An optimistic Noah Petro, a scientist on the LRO team.